Chapter 70. The Dismemberment of Austria-Hungary. The subjugation of over 3 million Sudeten Germans was the first move in subjugation of Austria. After the armistice of 1918, enormous mutilations would completely dismember the vast empire which had contributed so much to Western civilization. Over the centuries it had brought to most of Europe a political order without excessive rigor, a measured style of life, an amiability with gentle humor, and a remarkable culture. The arts and music flourished, and the tranquility of the Austrian order had created genuine peace and harmony throughout the empire. The Masonic guillotine would decapitate Austria. Its limbs and body would be thrown to its ravenous neighbors. From almost a 500,000 square miles, Austria would be reduced to 60,000 square miles. Only its head remained. The empire had shrunk to Vienna, surrounded by a little bit of land. From 50 million citizens, it was now 6 million. With its loss of territory and people, Austria was deprived of 90% of its coal, 60% of its iron ore, 80% of its hops, 75% of its fruit, 50% of its textile fibers, 39% of its wheat, 32% of its potatoes, 26% of its cattle, and 87% of its corn. While northern Austria was being parceled out to Beneš, the Allies delivered its southern part to Italy. After victory was achieved, the Allies tried to renege on the promises they had made to lure Italy into the war, but the Italians managed to acquire South Tyrol and its 250,000 German inhabitants. There was not the slightest reason for Italy to claim this German land and its people except in the words of the Rome government, "Our strategic border lies at the Brenner." In order to secure it, these 250,000 Germans, whether they like it or not, will have to come under our power. Once more, Wilson's self-determination clause, which the Allies and the Italians agreed to respect at the armistice, was not worth the paper it was written on. If the British and the French politicians were well aware that 250,000 Germans would be traded off to Italy, Wilson remained blissfully ignorant that there were Germans in the South Tyrol. His biographer, Ambassador Bullitt, wrote, "He gave Southern Tyrol to Italy because he did not know there were Austrians of German blood south of the Brenner." President Wilson, page 242. On this matter his allies took great care not to enlighten him. The destruction of the Austro-Hungarian Empire came at a time when its emperor, Charles, had already started the process of granting autonomy to the various nationalities which comprised it. Archduke Ferdinand, who had been assassinated at Sarajevo on June 28, 1914, was preparing to give the Serbs an autonomy similar to that of Hungary. Charles had negotiated with the Czech politician Tusker, who happened to be a socialist, the creation of a Bohemian nation in exchange for Czech loyalty. Other nationalities were already enjoying their own culture and customs. The empire was a loose federation of very diverse peoples united by a common Western heritage and civilization. The emperor ruled with benevolence and enlightenment, without the violence and massacres employed by the Soviet, British or French empires. The Austrian Empire's major fault in the eyes of world Freemasonry was its Catholicism. It was a Masonic article of faith that Catholic power had to be destroyed wherever it existed, particularly in the hands of Catholic kings or emperors. Catholic Europe had to be replaced by Masonic Europe. Lenin was keen to oblige the Freemasons in aiding in the destruction of Austria. He welcomed the creation of little countries ruled by corrupt and ruthless Masons. He would no longer be faced with the Eastern bulwark Austria had represented over the centuries. Austria's fall would breach that wall and throw Europe open to conquest. The newly created Czechoslovakia of 1919 would soon become a forward bastion of the communists. The Czech Masons in power had immediately warmed to Lenin, and sent a delegation of Prague Jews to coordinate policy with the Soviet dictator's man in Budapest, Beryl Cohen, also known as Bela Kun. When the Soviets invaded Poland in 1920, the Czechs worked with them. Lenin had ordered the training, in Russia, of several Czech units, which were to become the core of the Czech army, and the Red Army's vanguard. The British intelligence officer Major Thompson predicted, "The Soviets will recover from their recent defeat at the hands of the Germans sooner than we think." In the meantime, it is this busy little Benes who will represent them in Slavism. Benes, a high-ranking Mason, was the principal coordinator of Freemasonry and Communism. He remained Moscow's man until 1935, when he made a grievous mistake. The Gestapo had allowed Benes' spies to steal highly classified documents dealing with a Red Army plot to overthrow Stalin. The Soviet dictator had so much faith in Benes's reliability that he immediately ordered the execution of Marshal Tukhachevsky as well as tens of thousands of officers of the Red Army. The Masonic hatred against Austria had spread among all the Allies. Public opinion had been conditioned by largely Masonic-controlled media to wallow in blind, irrational hatred. It was all-pervasive and had become part of the political and cultural life of France, Britain, and America. Anti-Germanism, a Masonic code word for anti-Catholicism, was being whipped up at every occasion, and particularly at election time. Politicians of the left or the right were trapped into beating the anti-German drum whether they were inclined to do so or not. Churchill recognized that politicians were riding a public opinion tiger, the leaders, elevated on the giddy summits of power and victory, were balancing precariously on the volatile platform of public opinion. There had been so much hatred whipped up against Germany that not even Clemenceau could satisfy his electorate's thirst for vengeance. No politician could ever be sufficiently anti-German. After years of relentless propaganda, the public had been conditioned to scream for more blood and more vengeance. However, Clemenceau, Lloyd George and Wilson would all be thrown out of office because they had satisfied public opinion. A Belgian socialist politician called Spock told his electorate, "I will follow you everywhere, even in your madness." Spock was realistic politically, but totally lacking in integrity and courage. It was this lack of vision which would dismember Europe. Hungary, the most Catholic and conservative part of the age-old empire, suffered the most savage mutilation. Vienna had 40% of Austria's workers and had been successfully infiltrated by Marxist agitators. In 1918, the socialists took power. Hungary, on the other hand, had not been infected with the communist disease. The Hungarians were self-sufficient farmers and artisans, intensely patriotic, Christian and traditional. More Catholic than Austria, it would be more mutilated. The Versailles Treaty would grab three-quarters of its territory, 232,578 square kilometers out of 325,411. Hungary would be left with 92,833 square kilometers. More than 13 million Hungarians, 13,279,516 to be exact, were delivered like slaves to Hungary's neighbors. From a population of 20,886,437 people, the Hungarians would be reduced to 7,602,871. In 1 year, Hungary lost two-thirds of its population. Northern Hungary was fed to the voracious Czech Masons. In the southeast, 3 million more Hungarians had fallen into Romanian hands. Their Tardieu had emulated Balfour. He had promised the Transylvanian Hungarians to the Romanian government in exchange for Romania's participation in the war on the side of the Allies. The Romanian politicians always considered corruption a virtue and saw in the war a tremendous opportunity for Byzantine profiteering. From 1914 to 1918, they had had their hands out to everybody. They received money from the Russians, then from the Germans, and again from Russia. They had been severely trounced by the Germans after declaring war on them. They sued for peace in exchange for giving the Germans a 99-year lease on Romanian oil fields. When Germany started to lose ground, the whole contingent of Bucharest politicians rushed to Paris, accompanied by their usual flock of prostitutes. Although their corruption and intrigues irritated Clemenceau in the extreme, 3 million Hungarians were nevertheless passed on to Romania. Since the plebiscites had consistently turned against the Allies, the Hungarians, like the Austrians, Germans, and Slovaks, would not be given the benefit of a referendum. Count Albert Aponyi, a leading Hungarian patriot, went to Paris, despite his advanced years, to plead his people's case at the peace conference. Do not dispose of these people as if they were a herd of cattle. Today will be tested the sincerity of those who have so often proclaimed the great principle of international justice and liberty. We are asking a plebiscite in all the regions, and we will accept its results. If our adversaries refuse to accept this test, their cause will be judged before the tribunal of human conscience. They would have resolved to subject to their yoke millions of unwilling souls. The venerable Hungarian patriot was treated like a criminal. Benes, the Masonic hatchet man, answered Count Aponii, as far as the future borders of Hungary are concerned, they have been definitively set at the peace conference and there will not be the slightest modification. Lutemps, December 2, 1919. With rage and hatred, Benes's Masonic co-schemer Tardieu added, there will not be any pity for Hungary. This Masonic hatred was shared by all the Allies. American delegate Bowman said of the pervasive Allied hatred, at every instant one had to give tangible proof of hatred against the enemy. Hungary was thus crucified at the Versailles Treaty not for its sins, but for its faith, a victim of rabid Masonic hatred and rapaciousness.